The path to the White House, still murky the day after the Iowa caucuses. By this time, on this day, we were supposed to know something about the 2020 race for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. We were supposed to know who inspired the voters of Iowa, who fell flat, and who outperformed expectations. Needless to say, we don't. The results from Iowa have not been released, apparently because of technical snafus. Most of the candidates are now right next door, in New Hampshire, getting ready for that state's first-in-the-nation primary. I'm Jennifer Rooks. How will the situation in Iowa affect what happens in New Hampshire, if at all? Do these early states even matter? Can any of these candidates beat President Trump in November? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yesterday, the first votes of the 2020 presidential election were cast. While we still may not know the results of the Iowa caucuses, we do know that our neighbors in New Hampshire are next up in the race for the White House. Today, we're going to discuss how the race stands and what to look for in the coming weeks and months. On the line with us from Washington, D.C., Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. And joining us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, Neil Levesque. He is Executive Director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, which is part of St. Anselm College. And St. Anselm is also the site of this Friday's Democratic presidential debate. As always, we want to hear from you. How closely are you following the presidential campaigns? Do you have a favorite candidate? Is there an issue that matters most for you? One issue that you will vote, your vote will be based upon? Share your thoughts by emailing talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And on our Facebook page, you can make a comment in the comment section. Thank you both so much for being here. This is day is changing by the minute. Just as I walked into the studio, I was told that the folks in Iowa have announced that they will start to release some of the results this afternoon, possibly have half of the results by 5 o'clock. Gene Cummings, how much does it really matter anyway?
Well, it does. It matters in a great number of ways. First of all, whoever is the winner is going to get like a delayed boost. And even as we start the campaigning in New Hampshire in earnest, depending on who wins, let's say if it from some of the folks who've been on the ground and done some reporting, the thinking is that the Mayor Pete had a pretty good night and he could use a boost to his fundraising to move him along. That'll be delayed until we know exactly what the results are. But ultimately, I think the biggest impact of this is that Iowa now is at great risk of losing its stature as being the first nominating contest. They have long been under pressure to justify that position in the Democratic Party in particular. That's because the voters in Iowa in the Democratic Party are mostly white, and they're very liberal. And so they don't really reflect the party generally. And that's been a gripe of many people. And already we're hearing voices right from the get-go this morning that Iowa caucuses have outlived their usefulness.
And Neil, I want to turn to you on that thought that Gene is saying about how the Iowa caucuses don't represent the nation in large. People for a long time have been saying the same thing about New Hampshire. I mean, also a very white state.
Well, if you take the first four early states and you really combine them, I think it's a pretty good snapshot of the entire country. New Hampshire has a lot of diversity in a lot of different ways, economically and in many other aspects. So I think that the state goes first, and I think that the Iowa results, if anything, are more of a damning of the idea of what is a caucus? Is this a good way to pick a presidential nominee? And, you know, there's always the urge to go into new technology, as they did in Iowa with this new app rather than in here in New Hampshire, which is a statewide election run by the Secretary of State, run by the state. And it's really old school, paper ballots. And so next Tuesday night, we'll have a clear victor here in New Hampshire, and we're looking forward to it.
All right. You mentioned Gene Cummings, Mayor Pete. I saw Pete Buttigieg on CBS this morning, and he sounded like he thought he had won, chose the words carefully. Is this the same kind of information you are hearing?
Well, he is now trying to walk that back a little bit. He certainly gave the most definitive speech last night where he said, we are going to New Hampshire victorious. Basically, he was the only one who just flat out tried to claim victory. To me, it struck me as such a Bill Clinton New Hampshire moment. And many of your listeners may have been around when Bill Clinton lost in New Hampshire, but then walked out and declared himself in 1992 the comeback kid. And he did, in fact, grab some momentum and go on to win the nomination, obviously, and then the presidency. So it was a bold move for the mayor to do that. But, you know, this is a tough contest, and okay, maybe it was time for a bold move. If he comes in second, he's at least signaled that it'll be a strong second, or at least he better hope it is, because he's put himself out there.
Let me ask you this, Neil. You've got the debate coming up on your college campus. You're a big part of the planning for that. Who do you expect to qualify, and do you believe that Mayor Bloomberg will qualify?
I don't see that he's going to qualify for this Friday's debate. I expect that he'll go on to the next one, which I believe is in Nevada, and qualify there. We are picking up in some of our polling some interest in Michael Bloomberg. He certainly has paid for it. He's spent $250 million so far, so I would expect that he's going to show up somehow in polling. Just going back a little bit on the Buttigieg thing, you know, the thing, Buttigieg was smart to declare victory. I think that you know, the big sleeper in this whole election is the fact that Buttigieg has not really taken the national stage as much as he has here in New Hampshire. He has more donors from New Hampshire than any other candidate. I would easily say that he has more signs on lawns and more activists here in New Hampshire. He does very well in our polling. So he could be a real surprise that comes out of New Hampshire next Tuesday.
What are you seeing in your polling, Gene?
Well, we do the national polls, so we don't have state polling. But our most recent poll had Bernie and Biden really right next to one another, with then Mayor Pete, and then Bloomberg actually came in fourth. Now, we're a national poll, so it's not that instructive for primary races, but it certainly shows that the amount of advertising Bloomberg is doing is definitely having an impact. The other thing that our poll showed is the vast majority of Democrats across the country say they have seen a Bloomberg ad. So, you know, he's a smart businessman. He knows how to run a campaign, or his team does, and he's putting together a very professional, well-oiled operation, and is prepared to blow $1 billion of his own money trying to get to the White House. And we've never seen it before. We don't know what kind of impact it's going to have. We've seen races where a candidate has hung back and tried to enter the primary races late in the game, notably Mayor Giuliani in the Republican primary a few years back. Held out of the early states and tried to engage in the race in Florida, and it didn't work at all for him. But he also didn't have all kinds of money behind him. So Bloomberg is going to be something we've never seen before. And if Biden falters in three of the top four of the early four states, which could very well happen, then Bloomberg stands there on Super Tuesday to become the instant alternative for those who support Biden.
Interesting. Neil, I know that New Hampshire voters like to meet the candidates, expect to meet the candidates. How much time has Mike Bloomberg spent in New Hampshire?
Well, we actually hosted him for our signature event called Politics and Eggs a year ago. He was a great candidate. He's chosen not to participate in the first four races. Now, I'm a big promoter of the New Hampshire primary, obviously, and I don't want to though say that what he's going to do wouldn't necessarily work. I think the jury is out. If anybody can win not participating early, it would be Bloomberg. He has national name recognition, spending $1 billion. That's a pretty good jump. And usually what happens with Iowa and New Hampshire in the early states is that you start getting momentum and you start getting all kinds of fundraising that follows your victors. He doesn't need that. So I think the big question is for Bloomberg is, what's Joe Biden going to do here? Is he going to do well or is he going to falter? And then you have the factor that Bernie Sanders has sort of a movement behind him. He did it 4 years ago, too. He was denied the nomination. He's pretty sore about that, and so are a lot of his supporters. If he wins Iowa and then, say, wins New Hampshire, and then all of a sudden he gets stopped by a Bloomberg, that's a problem for the Democratic Party in general because they need the energy that sort of some of these movement candidates can produce, and they don't want to have a group of voters in the Democratic Party who are not going to turn out in November.
Before I go to June and Caribou, in just a minute, I want to ask you, Gene, if you have any response to what Neil's saying. It's a possibility, isn't it?
It definitely is. And what Bernie and his supporters have already demonstrated is that they are sore losers. And so it is going to be difficult for the party to manage him a second time around. They showered him with praise and attention at the DNC convention 4 years ago. They changed the rules. I mean, part of the problems that we're having in Iowa stem from the fact that Bernie's people demanded more transparency because they didn't believe they lost the Iowa caucuses to Hillary Clinton by half a percentage point 4 years ago. So they were the ones who demanded all these changes in the way the vote is counted. They didn't demand the app, but that's not their fault. But the way the process was changed was based on their demands. So they have shown they can be a major problem after a loss. And I completely agree that they will create problems for the party again if he is blocked and a billionaire businessman ends up being the party's nominee.
And related to what you all are talking about, Catherine on Facebook writes, I'm not 100%, but I'm leaning towards Sanders on Super Tuesday since his supporters are the most passionate. I would vote for a moldy shoe over Trump, but many Sanders supporters are, quote, Bernie or bust, exactly what you all are talking about. I'm going to go to June, who's calling from Caribou. Hi, June. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Apparently, your panelist hadn't read the WikiLeaks for herself. Bernie and his supporters are not sore losers. And I'm just very concerned with the state of the media, even NPR, who does take corporate cash. And the coverage last night was very skewed. And the job of the media is to report to hold our government in check and to root out corruption. And yet, without investigation, they declare anything that is brought up of concern a conspiracy theory. And yet today, The Intercept, which is one of the last really good investigative journalists places to go, Li Fang reports that a firm called Shadow developed the Iowa Dem Caucus app. They haven't responded to comment, neither has the Iowa Dem Party. The firm was paid for by the Nevada and Iowa Democratic Party, also huge contributions from Mayor Pete's campaign. So I've yet to see anyone in mainstream media addressing who made this app, who paid for this app.
Okay, June, I understand your point. I will say that I read an article about this in the New York Times, so I think that's mainstream media. But Gene, I'm going to toss it to you. What do we know about the money behind this app?
Yes, it was we also have coverage of this, so you can read it on the Wall Street Journal's website as well. But basically, it's a little convoluted. The company that invested in Shadow has a different name, and it was founded by some Democratic supporters of Hillary Clinton, and they invested heavily in Shadow. Shadow created the app. So where things get a little convoluted is that one of the founding owners of the investment group, her husband is a top-level political strategist to Mayor Pete. So there are some who are trying to make some kind of connections here that suggest if Mayor Pete were to come out as a winner, that somehow by making the investment in shadow, that there's like these dots can be connected, and that the shadow app somehow was rigged to help Mayor Pete. Now, the problems we see with this theory, and of course we are still reporting, so don't take this as the definitive word, because we're learning more every minute. But the one skepticism, big skepticism that we bring to the table on this with this data, is that Mayor Pete and the investment company, they didn't pick this shadow company to build the app. The Iowa Democratic Party and the Nevada Democratic parties, they picked it. And they have, neither one of them had an investment in trying to help Mayor Pete. So that's kind of the disconnect that we see here in trying to draw a straight line. But these, you know, these, all of these folks are very hardcore Democratic activists. And so they've crossed each other's lives over the years in many different ways. So that's another thing, that there be connections. Is that surprising? Not really. So, but we're looking at it. You know, we're investigating it. And certainly Shadow, not so much the investment company, but Shadow has put out statements, and they've got a lot of explaining to do. And we'll see if Nevada sticks with them. We also are reporting that today to see if, having seen what happened in Iowa, if Nevada decides to ditch this new app. Nevada knows how to run a caucus the old-fashioned way, and they could go back to their tried-and-true practices and just do it that way and skip the new modern app.
June, thanks so much for your call. We are going to go to a quick break. We're talking about the race for the White House. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Your Vote 2020 programming is made possible by your support and by MEMIC, who believes in a balanced workers' compensation system for Maine employees and employers. Learn more at MEMIC.com. By AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. AARP.org/ME. And the law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine.
A conflict with Iran.
We caught a total monster, and we took him out.
A new Mideast peace plan.
Today, Israel has taken a giant step toward peace.
A contentious impeachment trial.
They're impeaching me. You know why? Because they want to win an election.
President Trump will have a lot to cover when he addresses a joint session of Congress. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for live special coverage of the 2020 State of the Union from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
When you need to know what's happening in the world, you tune in to Maine Public Radio. Whether it's news out of Washington or updates from Augusta, you trust NPR and Maine Public Radio to help you grow more informed. It's reporting you rely on, and reporting that you make possible. When you donate to Maine Public Radio, you help bring quality journalism to your entire community. Do your part by giving at mainepublicradio.org/donate. And thank you.
Our Let's Grow Together membership is scheduled to start tomorrow. You can contribute right now at mainepublic.org or by calling 800-866-1475. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, the race for the White House. My guests are Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, and Neil Levesque, Executive Editor of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, which is part of St. Anselm College. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Lauren Chulgin, who is a political reporter with the New Hampshire Public Radio and host of a podcast called Stranglehold. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for calling us today.
Thanks, Jennifer.
I understand you are in deep. Wondering if there's any chance New Hampshire will run into any of the problems we've seen in Iowa.
Well, I think we've all learned that we should not be in the business of predicting anything, because anything can happen. But we have a very different system, obviously. You know, we've got old-fashioned ballots. But I will say that the pressure that Iowa has felt to be perfect and to make sure this thing goes off without a hitch, we feel that in New Hampshire, too. And so I think that just like it is every 4 years, but maybe even a little bit more so, that the eyes of the world are going to be on New Hampshire to make sure that there are results delivered on election night like they usually are.
I don't know if you heard the beginning of the program, but there was some conversation about Mayor Pete and how he seems to have really declared a victory of some sort. I know that you've been traveling this morning with him. What is he saying on the trail this morning?
Yep, I'm sitting outside his next event in Portsmouth right now, actually, so kind of close to you guys. And basically, that is correct. He has kind of been doing a victory lap. He was in Nashville this morning with the mayor of Nashville, who endorsed him. And as he walked in, you know, he kind of said offhand that it is frustrating, but they are looking at this as a victory. And, you know, when the mayor of Nashville talked to reporters after the event, he also said, you know, good win for Pete last night. And we all asked him, look, like, the results aren't out yet. The official results aren't in hand and won't be now, we know, until after 5 o'clock tonight. And they're still chalking this up as a win. And I know other candidates are going on TV and having some speeches around the state and kind of trying to pick and choose where they can call a victory from last night. But the truth is, we really just don't know how it shook out. And frankly, it looks like we probably won't know the full story even when we get the majority of these results later this afternoon. And so, you know, of course, you know, here in New Hampshire, we like to say that we have our own independent view on these things, right? That voters don't necessarily decide what they're, who they're going to vote for based on what Ireland is going to do before us. But the thing is that every voter I've talked to who's looking for somebody in the Democratic field has said to me, I mean, literally nearly every voter, that what they're looking for is who can beat Donald Trump. And so when those results come in, that is going to be some evidence for some people that this is a person who's been able to win in some respect, right? And so I think that that may factor into the decision that New Hampshire voters make whenever we get that result.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for giving us a call from the campaign trail. That's Lauren Chulgin, a political reporter with the New Hampshire Public Radio podcast, Stranglehold. Thanks so much for calling in. Jean, I want to talk about something Lauren just said. Most voters, it seems, this time around are voting, or many voters are not voting with their heart, but rather with their head, and they're all trying to be strategists. I'm sorry, Jean, are you there? Shoot, seems like we've lost Jean Cummings. I'll turn that question to you, Neil. Is this what you're hearing from voters?
Absolutely. When you have a polarizing figure like Donald Trump, a lot of Democrats are looking at this as an opportunity to pick a candidate who they can think can beat Donald Trump. So they may fall in love with a candidate through the summer and through the fall. But now that, you know, we're getting pretty close to the primary, things usually solidify. And right now, of course, who can beat Donald Trump is a very subjective thing. So when we do polling, we ask that question. We find it very, very insightful. And right now in New Hampshire, Joe Biden has led that pretty consistently throughout the year, that he is considered the best candidate by Democrats in our polling to beat Donald Trump. That is a really significant advantage that he has going into next week. It's why our polling really shows him up at the top. And we think it's probably the best advantage that he has. Democrats at this point, you know, you had to feel bad for a Democratic activist who didn't like the result of 2016, who maybe thought the Mueller report was going to turn in a different way, who had was watching impeachment and was very dissatisfied about what will happen tomorrow. And then Iowa comes and there's no answer there. And so New Hampshire could be very interesting, where all of a sudden Democrats say, OK, we're going to have a chance to pick a candidate here And this candidate hopefully will win the nomination and then go on to win the presidency.
Gene, I understand we have you back, which makes me happy. Talking about this idea that voters, instead of necessarily voting with their hearts, obviously many Bernie supporters voting with their hearts, but many, many Democratic voters this time around seem to be voting with, you know, trying to put on their pundit hat and trying to just figure out who might beat Donald Trump.
I absolutely agree with what we've been saying, and that's certainly what our polls show. That is the number one attribute that Democratic primary voters say they are looking for, and that's why winning matters, and perhaps even more so in this cycle than we've seen in others. In prior cycles, you know, Iowa could be a winnowing state, and New Hampshire then could start really settling on who are the front runners, and then we get the voices of minorities weighing in Nevada and South Carolina. But this time around, if you claim you're going to beat Trump, then you got to beat Bernie. And if you claim you're going to beat Trump, you got to beat Pete. You know, so you can't. This is what's so dangerous for Biden is, OK, don't win in Iowa, but stay close. Keep it a muddle. Maybe he did that. Maybe he didn't. Go to New Hampshire, where Bernie is favored in some polls because of the proximity. OK, maybe Biden can kind of write that off as a regional primary. But that's it. Then you got to start winning. And we have not seen strong evidence of a machine in Nevada. And he's really counting on the African-American vote in South Carolina to carry him through there. If he loses Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, and then gets to South Carolina, how many people are going to believe this guy can beat Trump? That's the danger to Biden.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from South China. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. I consider myself Bob the Boomer. I can say that. I feel I'm a progressive, and I really support Bernie. And on the two issues is Medicare for all and the environment. Those are two important issues. And what you were just saying is turnout, turnout, turnout. And I feel Bernie has a big group of people. He's exciting people to come out and vote. So I think he's the one that can beat Trump. And just to go back to the caller from Caribou that you had on, you know, in terms of getting a good take on what's going on, I highly recommend this show called The Hill Rising, which you can find on YouTube, a daily show that has a really progressive, both new conservative and new liberal perspective, which I think is really needed in this time.
Thank you so much, Bob, for your call. And Gene and Neil, I want to talk to this idea of energy versus strategy. It seems to me that there's a big debate within the party between who has the energy behind him or her and who is the sort of old-fashioned let's win in the swing state candidate. Am I reading that right?
I do see that defines this primary. There are lots of Democrats who believe that in the last cycle, the party went safe, picked someone well-known, established, and they lost. And so why go down that path again? That a different way has to emerge, a different player. So that's, and Bernie, of course, stands there at the ready to kind of redo what could have been the 2016 campaign. And his people are very passionate and very charged up. And the alternative argument is that you've got to win Pennsylvania, and you got to win Wisconsin, and you got to win Michigan. And that Biden is the candidate that has more strengths in that regard and that he could do it. Same argument for maybe Klobuchar, same argument for Mayor Pete. So the that defines this, where the debate that's going on within the Democratic Party, and that is what will be settled in these primaries. And we saw in 2018 the suburbs flip, mostly because of women votes. And many of them had voted Republican. And so those are the voters that need to, the Democrats say they need to hang on to defeat Trump. So if you look at it in terms of, as you say, strategy, if you had a Biden-Klobuchar ticket, well, that puts Pennsylvania very much in play because Biden is, you know, views that almost as his home state, and Klobuchar hails from out Midwest and could have appeal in Wisconsin and Michigan. That's a more natural blend. So that you exactly defined what this fight is all about in the primary.
Neil?
Well, I think I have a little bit different perspective slightly. You know, Biden's campaign is, look, let's go back to the Obama thing, normalcy. You know, I can win. I can beat this guy like a drum. That's his sort of MO. And Sanders really is, look, the only way to beat Trump, because he has a movement, is with a movement. And so that's sort of boiling it down. I think that, you know, some of these candidates, though, you know, there's more to than just the sort of top line theme that they go. Biden has had a very sort of lackluster campaign. He does sort of the Richard Nixon 1968 model, which is, you know, you do one event a day. It's mainly for TV. You sort of take it easy after that. Read your lines. He has a note card with him to do, you know, his canned speech, if you will, which is at this point in time sort of unusual. His schedule is very light. And the question is whether or not someone who's campaigning at that level can really go the stretch all the way to November. One of the big things, the signs of the holes there with the Biden campaign is the Bloomberg, you know, coming into this race. He saw this as Biden's never going to be able to get all the way to the finish line, and so therefore I'm getting in. So it was a real damning of that. And there are some real divisions, as I mentioned earlier, between the Sanders folks who believe they were denied and whether or not that happens to them again. Just stepping back quickly, you know, the Trump campaign manager yesterday seized on that and said, you know, that he was looking at this as they were trying to deny a group of voters with the Iowa results or non-results a voice in the process. They're sowing those seeds in there because they know that if Sanders doesn't get this nomination, they're going to try to go and get some of those disgruntled Democrats.
We have an email here from Greg. I don't see any candidate clearly pushing my top issue, rebuilding the middle class. Sure, candidates have lots of positions I like that will help, from taxing corporations to single payer to free college tuition to climate change. But all these dance around the fact that we used to be able to get into the middle class on a high school diploma. Well, if we were white, at least. We used to be able to raise a family on one salary, 40 hours a week. Despite of a forest of policies, I don't hear any candidate clearly promising to rebuild the middle class. That's what it will take to beat Trump, and I'm worried we're not hearing it. And this is from Greg. Jean, what do you think of that?
Well, they may not be making the appeal as directly as Greg would like to hear it, but if you take their policies and put them together, that is the goal. So when you look at, say, all of the candidates have some platform position on how to deal with healthcare costs. All of them have some kind of position on how to deal with college costs. And all of them have infrastructure plans, which would create good-paying jobs. So if you they may not have put the umbrella over their policies that say we need to rebuild the middle class. They are their platforms and their policy prescriptions that they would take into the White House are aimed at those things. So all of them would change the tax code to give middle class families relief and increase taxes on the wealthy. And all of those tax increases would also be then invested in trying to prevent heavy debt for college students and in trying to launch new big infrastructure programs that would lead to the hiring and better people in better wage jobs. So they may not be using the label exactly right, but if, Greg, you dig down into the details, you'll see that every one of them is trying to would want to implement programs aimed at helping the middle class.
I'm going to send Neil you this tweet from Nissa. Nissa says, what is the state of the Republican Party in New Hampshire? Excuse me, the Republican primary in New Hampshire. Do we know if write-in votes for Bill Weld or Walsh will be accepted in Maine?
Well, I'm not sure about Maine. In New Hampshire, it's rather interesting. So if you're an undeclared voter, there's 410,000 undeclareds in New Hampshire. That's another word to say independent. There's 280,000 registered Democrats. You can go in as an undeclared and take a Democratic ballot. So if you're an independent, essentially, and you want to vote in the Democratic primary or in the Republican primary, you can do it. This is very different than other states. And we, you know, some people like John McCain have really capitalized on that in the past. So if you're a Republican, this is a state election. Just because Donald Trump is very popular within his own party, we're still having an election next Tuesday for Republicans. You can go in. You will get the Republican ballot. Bill Weld, for example, is on that ballot, just as Donald Trump is. And you can also write someone in. It'll be interesting to see, from my perspective, and it'll take some time to gather this up, how many of the Democratic candidates are written in on the Republican side of the ballot. I think that that's a fascinating thing. You know, think about New Hampshire and how many candidate touches there are, how much advertising. We're just immersed right now in the Democratic field, and it'll be interesting to see what those results are.
We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. We're talking on Maine Calling about the race for the White House. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Your Vote 2020 programming is made possible by your support and by MEMIC, who believes in a balanced workers' compensation system for Maine employees and employers. Learn more at MEMIC.com. By the law offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at JoeBornstein.com. And AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. AARP.org/ME.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The USS Katahdin was launched at Bath Iron Works on February 4, 1893. She was the second ship of the United States Navy to be named for Mount Katahdin. Although Katahdin's engines were more powerful than specified, Katahdin failed to reach the contracted speed of 17 knots, 20 miles per hour, requiring the passing of special legislation to allow her to be accepted by the Navy. The ship was decommissioned after the Spanish-American War in 1898.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine.
Hello, I'm Philip Young, host of World Affairs. Migration is one of the most contested issues facing our country. Next on World Affairs, we focus on U.S. policy under the Trump administration and how it influences public sentiment. New York Times journalists Julie Hirschfeld Davis and Michael Scheer document the decisions and the ideologies shaping U.S. immigration policy. Their new book is Border Wars: Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the race for the White House and reviewing the upcoming New Hampshire primary. My guests are Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal, and Neil Levesque, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, which is part of St. Anselm College. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I wanted to go back to what we were talking about before the break, which was that in New Hampshire, you have an open primary. Martin on Facebook, who we know used to be a state rep here in Maine, says, I am an independent and open primaries would bring more people into the process. A lot of people advocating for an open primary system here in Maine. We're going to go to George calling from Waterville. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, folks. Great show, great panel. quick question here. So the Bernie campaign, again, it just seems that the cards are stacked against them. They kept him in Washington during the caucus, basically the poll right before the caucus was not released. Now we have this debacle last night. What does your panel believe is happening to Bernie? Is this going to happen again? Thank you.
Well, let me jump in here. This is Neil. I've been alluding to the fact that, you know, if you take certain sort of points, like the poll not being distributed, like what happened to Iowa recently, what happened 4 years ago, and some of the things that have come out about the superdelegates, et cetera, and you get to this sort of narrative where a lot of people who support a candidate very passionately, you know, are feeling like the process is not helpful to them and their candidate can't win no matter what because the deck is stacked against them. And that can be trouble because the other side will try to sow as much discontent into that and build that narrative up as much as possible. And they're not the only ones. So the Biden campaign, you know, is sort of if rumor has it that they didn't do well in Iowa, if that is factual, they, you know, we're talking about sending lawyers in today and sort of checking the process, and they're going to try to discredit it as much as possible as well. They see an opening to do that, and if it gains them an advantage, then apparently they're going to try to do that. So we're seeing a lot of sort of dangerous things out here, you know. But you know, I think he's a United States senator. As far as being kept in Washington for impeachment, that was his duty, and there are. In my long time in politics and being a bipartisan person, I hear a lot about, you know, conspiracies, and I hear a lot about, you know, biased press and things like that. And to be honest with you, I actually find that quite far from the truth almost always. And I find that there's a lot less conspiracy theories that are true, and there's a lot less bias in the media than people believe there is. And so maybe this will bring the Bernie people to life here in New Hampshire in the next several days, and he'll pull a big victory off going into Tuesday.
And Gene, this, we haven't really talked about the effect of the impeachment hearings and the fact that several of the candidates are U.S. senators and have had to stay in Washington. Do you believe this is going to have an impact on these early races?
Definitely not New Hampshire. I think they're all back in the state. They may have to scoot back to town to deliver a speech and cast a vote. But for this period where the senators are chatting amongst themselves, I don't believe they have to stay in Washington. Did it hurt somebody, anybody in Iowa? It may have, because Iowans, many, many of them make up their mind at the very end, and it's not uncommon in prior cycles that we would hear from voters in Iowa saying, I've got it down to two, I just want to see so-and-so one more time so that I can feel really good about how I'm casting my vote. And they didn't necessarily have that opportunity. The voters didn't. So that might have had an impact. The fact that the mayor could camp there might have had an impact on why he did well, if he did well. But he seems to think he did well. So I think if this is like many Iowa caucuses can be, where we're talking about three or four people coming out of Iowa really bunched together, then maybe it did have an impact. Maybe somebody lost their point. Or somebody gained a point or two because of the final dynamics. But I would say that the three senators who got trapped in the chamber, and as Neil said, doing their duty, they all three had very good operations and they had very good surrogates. So they were represented well in those days just before the caucuses. And now any disadvantage is gone.
We'll go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Yes, another very thoughtful program. Thank you. I'm sorry and I'm embarrassed to say that one of my first thoughts was about the conundrum of the caucuses not being able to produce a result based on software and telephone malfunctions. My first thought was about corruption of that system, hacking of that system. And what more do we need to get our public reassured that these are legitimate, thoughtful, accurate programs, as opposed to something that might be even subtly affected by some outside influences, or as in an obvious thing like a software glitch?
Ellery, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think a lot of people are really worried about this. And Jean, are we really 100% certain that this was not hacking?
Well, I thought it was fascinating that one of the first statements that Iowa Democratic Party put out was that it was not. And so they clearly wanted to make sure people understood that from their perspective, this was not some outside group or group of hackers or something like that. They recognized they had a coding problem on their hand and not somebody coming in from the outside. But the fact that that was the first thing they said and that it came to mind for many, many people shows how worried we are that our election system is not secure enough. And Iowa Democrats are certain to rue the day that Department of Homeland Security offered to test their system. They said thanks, but no thanks. And they didn't run through drills. So a lot of people were logging into the app for the first time on the day of the primaries. I mean, there's so many obvious lessons to be learned that we could take away from this. But I really, you know, I think I don't want to sound paranoid, but what we have learned, I mean, I think everyone should be very much on alert that the Russians will be back. They interfered in our election in a very successful way from their perspective. And so what's the disincentive? They're going to, you know, we all have to be on guard. We in the media watching to cover it, investigate. Everyone with the election systems should be on guard. And that is one reason why the Iowa Democrats should have invited Department of Homeland Security in, because the Homeland Security is looking out for the Russians as well.
Neil?
Well, again, this is it's the first thought that came to the caller's mind when this happened. And isn't that sad that this is what we're looking out for in a post-2016 world? And I do think we need to be very, very watchful of what goes on. And I think that that's why some of these old school ways of doing elections like we do here in New Hampshire with paper ballots, it's pretty hard to hack a paper ballot. And so therefore, we've never had a problem in the New Hampshire primary as far as counting votes. And I expect on next Tuesday, it'll be the same.
And same thing Secretary of State Matt Dunlap says about here in Maine. Paper ballots hard to hack. Thank you so much, Ellery, for your call. We're going to go to Richard calling from Sebago Lake. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. That was quick. I'm a liberal Democrat. I like a lot of the candidates that are up at this point. I will vote for whichever one gets the nomination. But more importantly to me is the situation in the Senate. I think Mitch McConnell is a lot more of a problem than even Trump. And there's a possibility Trump could get reelected. So I think it's important that we start focusing on the Senate. I think Susan Collins has some very big difficulties here in this state. And I have a question. I'm not really familiar with a lot of national politics. What other states might I send $20 to a viable Democratic senator candidate?
Richard, thanks so much for calling in. And Jean, Richard brings up a good point that the and one thing I wanted to ask you is how much do these individual Senate races impact the presidential race or the other way around?
Well, that's a complicated question. They do impact each other in very much so. But let me start first with his question. There are many people in the Democratic Party in Washington that feel as you do, and they are focusing on the Senate and House. And if from what we understand from our reporting around Bloomberg, is if Bernie becomes the nominee, then Mayor Bloomberg intends to pivot and pour his money into the Senate races. So there are five other competitive races out there other than your own in Maine, four, that we in the media have got eyes on. And that's Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, and North Carolina, where Republican incumbents are facing the same kind of dynamics as your Senator Collins. And then there's also the race in Alabama, where Democrat Doug Jones is facing the reverse. He's in a very tough race, depending on who the Republicans nominate. But he's fighting for his life out there. And then a long shot one to keep your eye on is Kansas. Because now that Senator Pompeo is Secretary Pompeo has said he's not going to go home and seek the Republican nomination for the Senate there, there's a good there are better odds that the GOP nomination will go to Kris Kobach, who is a very, very hardline anti-immigration person who the Republicans fear could lose to a moderate Democrat. So those are the races where your $25 might make a difference. Now, how do things change when we've got the presidential? Is that most people are going to cast their vote for a president, and the notion of party switching is a notion of the past. And so what you don't see is people, you know, yeah, I'll vote for Trump or I'll vote for his Democratic opponent, but then I'm going to switch back to the other party for the Senate race. And that also is important with some of these moderate House races where the Democrats stole, you know, these flipped these really close Republican seats and they were Trump seats. And now those House Democrats have got to go win on their own with Trump at the top of the ticket. So that's going to change the turnout dynamics a lot and in a way that's not favorable to them. So the Democrats are fighting to hold that House majority as well. And the dynamics change because the turnout changes when you've got President Trump at the top of the ticket.
Richard, thanks for your call. And Jean, thank you for that quick explanation. Just a few seconds left. I want to turn back to you, Neil. Tell us the details of the debate. When, what time, and what can we expect in about 10 seconds, please?
Friday night at 8 o'clock, there's 1,700 people in the audience. There will be 1,000 members of the press. And two nights before that, CNN has four town halls 200 yards away from the debate stage.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That's Neil Levesque, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, which is part of St. Anselm College. Also here, Jean Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. This is Maine Public Radio.